From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. On the show today, from Nixon to Obama, the danger of presidents using mandates as the rationale for policy decisions.
When presidents justify their decisions in terms of what they promised they would do and what they were elected to do, it kind of puts the decision in the hands of the voters in a way that it sounds democratic, but, you know, there's a way of thinking about democracy that's kind of about, you know, we elect leaders and we want leaders to exercise good judgment.
50 years ago this week, the Beatles played their only concert in Milwaukee. We'll talk with a man who introduced them that day. And we'll learn about the 19th century forerunner to big-time spectator sports, pro walking.
There would be brass bands playing music. Celebrities would stop by. You might see Tom Thumb at one of the big walking matches in New York City. So people went not just to watch people walk, but also for the spectacle.
Lake Effect next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. It's Labor Day, and while many of us pause to consider the work that we and our neighbors do year-round, we're going to pause today and consider three facets of history. We start with politics. As President Obama is scheduled to speak today in Milwaukee, his personal approval and disapproval ratings among Wisconsinites are evenly divided. It's a far cry from the mandate that the president and his political allies cited after his reelection 2 years ago. But what would constitute a mandate anyway, and how have presidents used the idea of a mandate to justify policy? Julia Azari tackles those questions in a recent book called Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. Azari, who's assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, joined us in the studio last month to talk more about mandates. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the nature of mandates in general here. The mandates are not a recent concept, but what is more recent is how its use has kind of evolved in more recent years.
Correct. I first got interested in the subject of mandates when I was a graduate student, and the question came up kind of in the, you know, in the shadow of the 2004 election. The question came up about what constitutes a large enough victory to be a mandate, right? Are some victories special? And if so, you know, what's the threshold? So if some elections really confer some unique and special authority on the president or on any elected official for that matter, is the cutoff 50%? Is it a majority? Is it 55%? You know, how do we determine that?
Well, and let me ask you a potentially dumb question. I mean, I think this is what you're getting at. Is there any way to separate a mandate from mandate rhetoric, mm-hmm. or is a mandate really something that only exists in rhetorical terms?
I think it's something that only exists in rhetorical terms. I will hedge about a lot of things, but I will say that unequivocally. I think that it is very difficult to take millions of votes and come up with some kind of meaningful picture out of that. The meaningful picture comes out of how we come to understand that, of the narrative that's spun out of that. And presidents are uniquely positioned to build that narrative. They obviously have a national stage. Rhetoric is a big part of what they do. But also presidents are uniquely positioned to need that narrative to justify what they're doing. And that's what I found. So stuck in this kind of intractable web of, well, how much is a mandate? What could possibly be a mandate? You know, you get in this kind of thing. And so theorists and political scientists say there's no such thing as a mandate. But every 4 years, and increasingly now, I think every 2 years after midterms, after gubernatorial races, everybody rushes to the question of, well, what did it mean? And is it a mandate? And so you have this kind of disconnection there between this concept that's really resonant. And if we're not voting for the government to do something in particular, then what are we doing? And yet these kinds of more thorny questions at the root. So I kind of said, you know, why mess with this question when we can just look at how do presidents use this? And that's where I found a story that was a lot different than what I think a lot of people would expect.
Right. I think as you turn back the clock and look at the early half, or really the first two-thirds of the 20th century, the concept of a mandate as it was used by presidents was a great deal different than we think of it today.
It was. So on the one hand, this book really focuses on the change that occurred in the late 20th century, where I find a real uptick in mandate rhetoric and in the importance of the mandate in presidential governance and the way that presidents not only talk about the mandate in national speeches to the electorate, but also to other people who are in government, to members of Congress, when they're addressing members of their own executive branch, also when they're out in the world and they're addressing and they're making a kind of local address to a smaller audience. I find that mandate rhetoric really kind of comes to the fore in a way that it didn't during the years of FDR, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson. But at the same time, I also find there's a kind of recurring pattern in the presidency, which is the presidents are constantly pushing at the boundaries of their authority. They're constantly doing things that are challenged by their opponents as really being outside of what the presidency should do or what presidents should do. And this goes back to Andrew Jackson and his contest with Congress over the Bank of the United States. And he used the mandate to justify his strong actions then. And then I find this pattern recurs through the 20th century. Franklin Roosevelt talked very little about the mandate after the 1932 election. He talked a lot about the crisis and about solving the crisis of the Depression. But when things started to get a little bit more challenging for him, after his second election, he was inaugurated again in 1937. At that point, the Supreme Court had invalidated a number of the important New Deal statutes. And Roosevelt was starting to fight back by threatening to change the structure of the Supreme Court. So he goes to Congress and has this proposal to reorganize the judiciary, to expand the court for every member over 70. And that's really received badly as a kind of dictatorial overreach. And that's when FDR starts trotting out mandate rhetoric. But it's not just – so the story about FDR I think is pretty interesting on its own. But then we see this occur over and over again. This happens with Richard Nixon, a kind of famous overstepper, where he refers to the mandate and to the election of – both the elections of 1968, which was a very narrow victory, and then 72, which was a broad victory, in the context of fights with Congress over the budget, fights with Congress and with, you know, with any number of opponents over Watergate. He used the idea of the 1972 mandate to defend himself against those charges. And what I argue is that in the wake of the Vietnam War – and Watergate and this kind of new public understanding of the danger of strong executive power, presidents are now kind of always dealing with this boundary situation and are in a much more defensive posture all the time than they were in the middle of the 20th century when public trust in the government and in the presidency was much higher, where the parties were much less polarized. And so to deal with this much more challenging and defensive environment, presidents have turn to mandate rhetoric, and that turn is really unrelated to election victory magnitude.
You point to Dwight Eisenhower as perhaps emblematic of presidents who sought to have broad appeal without necessarily invoking this idea of a mandate. Here's a guy who was elected fairly easily, but he did not necessarily invoke the idea that he had a mandate in trying to bring broad appeal to his policies.
Right. Eisenhower was pretty reserved about claiming mandates. He talked a bit about his campaign in 1953. After the 1956 election, he really didn't talk very much about mandates at all. And one time a reporter asked him and he told the reporter that, you know, he was embarrassing him. And, you know, a very Eisenhower-like deflection. And so there's some degree, as I was looking at these different presidents, there's some degree you see their personal styles come through. But even beyond the personal styles, there are also these patterns where presidents who are near each other in time, even when they're different in every other conceivable way, have some similar mandate claiming habits.
Is this like Bush and Obama as well?
Yeah, Bush and Obama, Carter and Nixon, and Eisenhower and LBJ. Those I look at those pairs in the book. With Bush and Obama, they're my two biggest mandate claimers after the elections of 2004 and 2008. Those are really – these are obviously two really different individuals. In some ways, the elections have some commonalities because they're both – kind of easily spun as party victories. But both presidents really make a lot of that. Whereas, you know, in contrast, in 1953, when Eisenhower was taking office for the first time, we had a kind of similar situation where the Republicans did really well. And Eisenhower really was much more reserved about making that case that the electorate had rejected Democratic policies, which was a big theme that Obama sounded a lot in 2009. He didn't talk so much about specific things he promised on the campaign trail. A lot of his references occurred in the context of either they were very broad, very general, or they occurred in the context of news news interviews. One thing I'd like to say just about kind of the way – you know, putting the book together that was fun was that after I created this larger data set of mandate rhetoric, I went to six presidential libraries. So I've got all of these kind of stories from the speechwriters and White House staffers and communications leaders within the different presidential administrations. And so the book really tries to go into and get a feel for, after the election had occurred and after the president took office, what did they really – you know, what were people saying about the election and what were they saying about the political challenges that they faced? Not just what do we remember now that everything's been nicely tied up by history, but what were they saying at the time? And especially for some of these older ones, looking back at the Johnson administration and at the Eisenhower administration, the way that their employees and their White House were – their White Houses were looking at problems is a lot different than how we remember them in some instances.
Do you think – is there a danger to governing in mandate rhetoric? Does it paint a president into a corner, if you will?
I think that it does. I think that the normative implications, the kind of how the world should be of this book are a little bit disturbing. First of all, the kind of governing from a place of defensiveness all the time isn't great. When we complain about presidents not having leadership or vision, this is kind of, I think, at the heart of that problem. There is a degree of painting into the corner, and I've been thinking a lot about this as Obama has been trying to deal with various situations in the Middle East. He campaigned with a specific idea about how he was going to conduct policy, and then events intervened. Undoubtedly, he learned new security information after taking office. Sometimes the mandate is kind of at odds with being pragmatic. Which, you know, there's a real contrast there if we look at FDR, who was all about experiments and solving problems, and his rhetoric was very much about that. Contemporary presidents, not so much. The other problem is that it kind of passes the buck to the electorate. You know, Truman said the buck stops here, but when presidents justify their decisions in terms of what they promised they would do and what they were elected to do, it kind of puts the decision in the hands of the voters in a way that it sounds democratic. But, you know, there's a way of thinking about democracy that's kind of about, you know, we elect leaders and we want leaders to exercise good judgment and to lead. And I feel like that has kind of fallen out, at least of presidential discourse over the last 30 years or so.
Well, and at the heart of this, when you go to the polling place and you flip a lever or you push a button or otherwise check a box, you're electing a person. It's not a laundry list of issues that you're necessarily signing off on.
Right. One thing that's interesting about that is that the development of mandate rhetoric has really kind of been about this parliamentarization of presidential politics. So, you know, in some countries that is what you do. You vote for a party, and sometimes you can't even see the candidates on the list, right? You just vote for the party. And American politics has traditionally been really resistant to that. But there's no question that our party system has become more issue-oriented, more polarized. And that presidents have become much more dependent on their parties for support. Obviously, opposition's become a lot more organized. The gap between the president's, you know, party supporters and those in the opposite party in terms of approval is huge. And it wasn't always. So there's a lot going on there in terms of this becoming more like that system. And yet that's not the system we have in place. And the presidency is really not designed to operate that way.
At the heart of all this, there is an inherent irony that the times when a mandate might truly exist in which the president is popular and has the greatest support are the times in which the idea of a mandate is invoked the least and vice versa. So if you say you have a mandate, you probably don't.
That seems to – I mean this gets again at the question of do you ever really have a mandate? But it's – I think it's safe to say that if you say you have a mandate, the chances are you're saying it because you feel threatened in some way. And that, right, presidents say this when they're the least popular. Sometimes presidents are popular and their policies aren't, or vice versa, which speaks again to this, the difficulty of really ever determining what a mandate is. But I think that it's right to say that when we hear presidents talking about doing what they were elected to do, based on the research I've done, there was probably a conversation about that that was about problems with public support. It was about the way – how well the opposition was organized or somehow about, you know, feeling like something wasn't going well. It tends to be defensive rhetoric. And although the patterns in how presidents have talked about mandates have changed, to some extent that is constant.
Where does Congress fall in this equation? I mean, clearly individual congressmen and senators can't claim a national mandate, but the parties seem to employ mandate rhetoric when pushing their own policy agenda.
I think that's right. One of the things that I note in the beginning and end of the book is that I think this is starting to kind of leak out of just the presidential arena. There are reasons why this was kind of a presidential concept at first. Part of that has to do with the national idea. When Andrew Jackson trotted this concept out in the 1830s, it was all about the president being the only person who was elected nationally. But now, as the parties have become more nationalized and as congressional elections and even, I think, gubernatorial elections have become more nationalized, I think I read somewhere that only 30% of Scott Walker's campaign money comes from within the state. And that's undoubtedly true in some other high-profile governor's races this year as well. I think that this concept is becoming more resonant for members of Congress and also in state-level politics. I think that the age of mandate politics has only just begun.
Julia Azari, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julia Azari's recent book is called Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate, published by Cornell University Press. Azari, who teaches political science at Marquette, talks about the book tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company. Our interview first aired earlier this summer. 50 years ago, a music group had a pretty clear mandate in Milwaukee. We'll remember the Beatles' one and only concert here when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
You say you will love me. If I have to go, you'll be thinking of me. Somehow I will know.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. 50 years ago this Thursday, the Beatles took the stage for the first and only time in Milwaukee. It was in 1964 on their first U.S. tour that the Fab Four played a show at the Milwaukee Arena, now known as the UWM Panthers Arena. It was a huge moment in the city's cultural history and an even bigger moment for the people who were there, such as Bob Berry. At the time, he was a disc jockey at WOKY Radio, and he was the man who introduced the Beatles on stage. His memories and those of a few of the fans in attendance are part of a documentary airing on Milwaukee Public Television this evening. Bob Berry and documentary producer, director, and writer Raul Galvan are with us in the studio now. Welcome to you both.
Thank you
for having us.
So let's go back to 1964 here. You were at WOKY and in the position of being the first guy to spin a Beatles record on the air in this city. But I gather your arm had to be twisted just a little bit.
That's right. Music director said, look, I want you to listen to this new record that just came in. She put it on the turntable. And it was I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I said, boy, I don't know. I said, I'm not sure about this one. And she said, look, trust me. And she opened up Cashbox and Billboard, the industry magazines, and said, look at how they – in Europe, they're the biggest things ever. You got to try – I tell you what, just play it on your show tonight and see what kind of reaction you get. So I did, and the reaction was incredible. And I said, oh, I guess I was wrong on that one.
This is sort of another era of radio when playing a record would result in dozens of phone calls to the switchboard.
Yes, we would premiere, we called it. We'd premiere these new records as they came in, whether they were Rolling Stones or the Dave Clark Five, and they were all hot at that time too. That was a big year for all of the British acts. The Dave Clark Five had been in Milwaukee before the Beatles were here, and they caused a riot at George Devine's ballroom at the Eagles Club. And so this is a thing that we would do and get the reaction and find out which records we should play.
And so it didn't take much to figure out that the Beatles were going over well.
Oh, yeah. It was phenomenal success right away.
Well, and I think the documentary points out that the record it was displacing on the U.S. charts was by The Singing Nun, right?
It had been the last hit, according to Joel Whitmer.
That's right.
Album.
And do any of you know which song actually knocked the Beatles out of number one?
Mm-mm.
It was Hello, Dolly by Louis Armstrong.
So really, top 40 radio was all over the map in the early 60s.
Oh, yeah. Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Rosemary Clooney, Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard. It was just a complete smorgasbord,
Well, and for – maybe it's hard for younger people today to imagine, though. There were points at which the top five records on the Billboard charts were all Beatles songs.
That's right. It's the only time that has ever happened in the history of music in the United States and anywhere else.
So the Beatles start developing a following here, and then you are called on to be the guy on stage to introduce them when the concert is scheduled. But again, you didn't really jump at the idea.
That's right. I emceed the Dave Clark 5 show when they were here. I emceed the Rolling Stones. I was paid $250. The other acts from the United States, like Paul Revere and the Raiders, I was paid $150.
That's good money.
That was great money at that time. And in fact, another radio announcer at the at the premiere the other day said, "Hey, we don't even get that today." So I asked him, they call me in and they asked me to MC the show, and I said, "How much does it pay?" And they said, "Well, we're not paying any of the disc jockeys on the entire tour of the United States." So I thought for just a second. I said, "Well, I think I'll take a pass then." So I said, "Okay," and hung up. And the music director said, "What was that all about?" And I said, "Well, it was Frank Fried from Triangle Productions in Chicago, and he wants me to emcee the Beatles show." Well, she said, "Well, what did you say?" And I said, "Well, they're not paying anything." So I said, "I'll take a pass." She said, "You got to be out of your mind. You know, call him back and tell him that you'll." And once again, she showed me Billboard, Cashbox, and said, "Hey, they're the hottest thing in the country. You got to do this." And I said, "Okay." So I called him back, and he said, "Well, we already called someone else at WRIT. But I'll call him back and tell him that you're going to MC it, and he'll introduce the warm-up acts and then introduce you."
I think these are pretty good warm-up acts, but they were not the Beatles.
Right, right. And then can you imagine introducing someone from an opposing station? That was tough for him to do.
Yeah. Raoul Galvan, in producing this documentary, you found a good number of people who were at that concert. How hard was it to find people with really strong memories of that era?
Well, we put out a Facebook call on the MPTV page, on my personal page, and then a couple people distributed on their pages. And it was surprisingly easy to find people. I think people who went to the Beatles concert in Milwaukee in 1964 are really proud and realize that they were at a somewhat historic event, and they loved to talk about it. as Bob would tell you, he talks to people all the time. And even since we were – since we had stopped taping because we started to edit, we kept – getting a couple of more calls because, I got a call from a lady in California asking me if the DVD would be available for sale because she had been married and had a wedding reception at the Coach House Inn on the 5th, the day after the Beatles were there. And she says a lot of her guests, several of her guests actually met them or saw them walk away. So people have all kinds of recollections.
Some of them may have saw her standing there.
There are things that happened at the Coach House, and like for instance the press conference.
Right. There's this great picture of you like kneeling in front of the Beatles table at the press conference.
WOKY didn't have a microphone stand, so I was holding the microphone. But what amazed me, and I told Raul that when we went back there to the room where the press conference, it's the same today as it was 50 years ago. Their room is exactly the same as it was. The room down the hall where we took the picture of the five of us, that's exactly the same as it was 50 years ago. So we go to the Milwaukee Arena. That's the same as it was 50 years ago. So it's you know, of course, it's called the UW Panther Arena now.
And the Coach House Inn is called Mashuda Hall.
Mashuda Hall, that's right. It's a Marquette dorm.
And in fact, Raul, you found a big Beatles fan among the Marquette students who live there. And I imagine there's a fairly small number of them with Beatles posters on their walls.
I know. We were freaked out. We were introduced to Sarah, who was a resident, an RA.
Yeah.
And I said, can we talk to you for a couple of minutes? And she took us into her room, and on the walls were Beatles posters. It's like, very bizarre. She knew about the story, but it wasn't as vivid until Bob explained to her and showed her and gave her a couple pictures, and she was really cute.
I gather people aren't sure exactly which room the Beatles stayed in, or even if they slept at all that night.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I don't know why they don't put a plaque in there. I mean, that
exactly.
would be kind of neat, you know.
You found some great clippings as well from the days leading up to the show. There were articles in which child development experts tried to convince parents not to let their kids go to the show. What was that all about?
Apparently, there was a negative. I mean, Bob had commented to me, not on the documentary, but that he got some nasty phone calls from parents back in the day. But there was some negative reaction towards the Beatles because of, you know, the big change that they brought about, and mostly because of the behavior they provoked in the young ladies who went to the shows.
What did the parents tell you when they called you?
Well, they just thought that this was music that their young people should not hear. And I don't quite understand that, because what's wrong with She Loves You? I Want to Hold Your Hand. If I Fell in Love with You. You know, they were all innocent love songs. Maybe it was the hints of some drugs, of their lifestyle, you know, and there were a lot of rumors, and the Beatles even mentioned that in the press conference, that they were really upset with the magazines and the newspapers that were spreading a lot of rumors that weren't true.
Many parents criticize you. Is there anything wrong with parents?
Well, you know, yes. Yes, there could be.
Do you think their disapproval makes the teenagers like you more?
I think we've got the majority of the parents as well, actually.
Yeah, you know, a lot of parents don't mind us, actually.
They write a lot of letters, too.
Well, we get letters from people about 90, you know. Honest.
Raul, you talked with this big variety of people. The crowd obviously was mostly young girls who went, but you found some males who had been there as well. This was not an acoustically perfect concert.
Anything but. You know, obviously sound reinforcement back in those days isn't what it is today. And the constant of everyone we spoke to was that could not hear the band. You could hear the screams. You could hear selected chords here and then. One woman told us she knew when Ringo was singing "Boy" or "Boys."
Boys, and, yeah.
Because she saw him move his lips, but otherwise she wouldn't have known anything was going on. In fact, there's Bob suggested that John Lennon might have not sung a lot because he had
laryngitis.
Well, and Bob, I think there were, what, four opening acts. What was the atmosphere at the arena by the time you were on stage to actually introduce the Beatles?
Okay, first I was at the press conference, which started around 7 o'clock. So by the time I got to the arena, the warm-up acts were already underway. And Jackie DeShannon came up, and later on she told me that she had to keep this crowd going, and it was tough because she had to sing songs that they could sing along to. She had to keep the crowd kind of going. And
this is a pretty thankless task, being the person singing before the Beatles come out.
So after she got off the stage, then they call on me to go up there, and I was introduced, and I thought, well, I'll tell a few things about the Beatles. And, of course, everything that I said, you know, Paul McCartney is not married. He told me he's not, you know, I told all the things that happened at the press conference and when I talked to him, I would really, well, and of course, they screamed each time I mentioned one of their names. So then I kept looking around and they're not coming in. So how long am I going to have to fill? That was the scariest time of my life, you know, to have to fill some more when they're waiting for the Beatles. They don't want to see me up there. So finally, I saw him come in, and all I said is the Beatles. Nobody heard that. But and then the guys from the Beatles, you know, the sound man and the, you know, they grabbed me and showed me which way to get off the stage. So I wasn't up on stage with them. Yeah.
Well, and in the aftermath of the show, you had, if I'm not mistaken, a van full of stuff that people sent to you hoping you would get it to the Beatles. What were the kinds of things people sent to this influential disc jockey?
All kinds of stuffed animals, rings, bracelets, really nice gifts, bottle of champagne. They had cakes, beautiful cakes. And I asked Paul, I said, what do you want to do with, you know, all this stuff? And he said, well, we'd like to keep the mail. We'll take that with us. But all the rest of it give to Children's Hospital or an orphanage. And Ringo said, I'll take the champagne.
Well, was there ever a point when you were around the Beatles on those couple of days where things weren't loud and crazy?
Well, yeah, in their hotel room, of course, when I did a short interview with them and we had some pictures taken, it was very quiet then. Paul was really the spokesperson for the group, which I guess we all imagine. And George was very serious. Ringo was clowning around, and John didn't say anything. He was, you know, he still had laryngitis, and he just wasn't feeling good. He was on medication. And
people referred to you as Beatle Bob, you know, and the reference goes that you were the fifth member of the Beatles, at least as far as Milwaukee goes.
Yeah, because there were about 150
right,
Beatles.
Exactly. when you think about those couple of days that you were around this, how important was it in the scheme of your years in radio?
Oh, it was huge. I was introduced the other night and someone said that I rode the coattails of the Beatles back in the 60s and I'm still riding them today. But it's really strange because in 68, new management came into WOKY. And the Beatles didn't have anything to do with me staying. The management said, and they were from New York and L.A., and they said, they fired everybody, and we're going to keep Bob because he knows how to pronounce Oconomowoc. He knows the area, and he's the only one that's from Milwaukee, so we're going to keep him. So then I had to prove myself, you know, all over again. And but they didn't think anything about the Beatles. That was no big deal.
Were you ended after you introduced them? Did you end up backstage while the concert was going on?
No, I did not. I was on the side of the stage, and I couldn't even hear anything.
That was going to be my question: whether you could hear the concert.
No, not even. I was sitting with Jackie DeShannon, and I asked her. I said, "Is this the way it is all over?" She said, "Yep, same thing in every city." Of course, their equipment was not what it is today, too. You know.
Do you think was there something special about that tour? I mean, it was the Beatles' first tour in the United States, and maybe it seems like it was at the most innocent moment of Beatlemania.
That's correct. Yeah, 65 and 66 were not the same, and of course they didn't go to as many cities either, just a few cities.
They and things, at least the Beatles, were starting to get, by 65 and 66, obviously disillusioned with touring.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah, they were fighting among themselves, and you know there were little squabbles and things, and so they said, "Nah, it's not fun anymore."
So, from an outsider's perspective, did it look like they had fun in Milwaukee?
Oh yeah, they were having a ball then. In Indianapolis, they even got a chance to ride around and, you know, tour around a little bit.
Raul, we were chatting about this the other day when we were setting up this interview. You were kind of amazed at how vivid these memories might have been, especially given your own memories of your first real concert.
Yeah, I was amazed because after I kept meeting these people and they were telling me stories about, you know, what the girl in front of them was doing and the girl with the glasses coming off and how everybody was screaming on the way, rewound to my first concert experience, which was I thought was pretty amazing, which was James Brown back in his heyday. And it had to have been in 64, 65. And I couldn't remember anything. I mean, and maybe it's my mind, but I think it's, you know, for me, it was one of a series of events that happened to me that perhaps weren't as significant as the Beatles in these people's lives. But most definitely it made an impact on their lives.
Bob Berry, do you have any recollection of what the next concert was that you announced after the Beatles concert?
I do not.
Were any of them the same ever again?
No.
Well, we are thrilled that you made time for us. Bob Berry, thanks so much. And Raoul Galvan, thanks so much as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Raoul Galvan is manager of program production for Milwaukee Public Television and writer, producer, and director of The Beatles Invade Milwaukee, which airs tonight, Thursday, and Saturday on MPTV. Bob Berry was the Milwaukee DJ at WOKY who emceed the Beatles concert here 50 years ago Thursday. You can see a picture of him with the Beatles at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then we'll go further back in time to when the most popular spectator sport in America was walking. Really? This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee Brewers are on a pace to draw 3 million fans to Miller Park this year as they make another run to the playoffs, and soon football stadiums around the NFL will be packed with fans. But turn back the clock to the 19th century, and the hottest ticket in town as far as sports were concerned was the sport of pedestrianism, watching people walk around a track, often for days at a time. It's a sport that's almost entirely forgotten today, or at least it would be forgotten if not for a recent book by writer Matthew Algio. It's called Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport. In an interview recorded at Boswell Book Company this spring, Algio explained what spectator sports were like in this country before pedestrianism came along.
There really weren't spectator sports in the United States before the Civil War. The population of the country was pretty widely dispersed. It was a primarily agrarian culture. It wasn't until after the Civil War, you have the Second Industrial Revolution, people begin moving into the cities, mass migration into the cities, and accompanying this are the construction of the first large public buildings. And these are the things that made spectator sports possible in the decades after the Civil War. The problem is there really wasn't much to do in the United States in the way of entertainment in the 1870s and 1880s. Most of the entertainment at that time was still geared toward the wealthy. And so a ticket to a play or a musical might cost a dollar or two when the average worker was lucky to make a dollar a day. And pedestrianism, as boring as it sounds to us today, to watch, really filled a void in the United States, and especially in the 1870s, by giving people something to do.
What was the confluence of events besides the fact that the Second Industrial Revolution happened, people had extra spending money, but what happened to get people behind the idea of walking?
It really goes back to a guy named Edward Weston, and he was a door-to-door book salesman from Providence, Rhode Island. And in 1860, he made a bet with a friend on the outcome of the 1860 presidential election. Weston bet his friend that Lincoln would lose. Lincoln wins, of course. Weston loses the bet. And the terms of the bet were that the loser had to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days and make it in time to see Lincoln's inauguration. And so Weston set out on February 21st, 1861, and began walking from Boston to Washington. And this really generated a lot of attention, a lot of excitement even in the country. People were really captivated by this, the idea that somebody would try to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days in the middle of winter, terrible roads. Everybody had experience with walking long distances at that time. And so I think people really empathized with Weston. He arrived actually 4 hours late. He missed the inauguration. But he gained such fame from this walk that after the Civil War, he began staging walking exhibitions. He'd go to a town, and roller rinks actually were springing up everywhere. Roller skating was very popular at the time. So he'd get to town, and he'd rent out a roller rink, and he'd attempt to walk, say, 100 miles in 24 hours. And people would come by the thousands just to watch him walk in circles to see if he could cover this 100 miles in 24 hours. People paid about 10 cents to watch this. And especially in smaller towns, there was really not much else to do. And so Weston gained quite a lot of fame and also made a lot of money and also attracted a lot of competitors. People came up and said, well, I can walk 100 miles in 23 hours or 22. And eventually this kind of mutated or evolved into the six-day walking matches that that really were the most popular form of the sport.
Well, so talk about what these events were like. Six-day walking matches were the most popular version of this. What would happen when you went to one of these things?
Well, first of all, you'd have usually the large arena in the city. In New York, it was Madison Square Garden. In Chicago, there was a building called the Expo, where the Art Institute stands now. But you would mark out a dirt track on the floor. It would usually be about a seventh or an eighth of a mile around. And the competitors would begin walking just after midnight, Sunday night, Monday morning. Of course, at that time, there were blue laws that prohibited any public amusements on the Sabbath. You couldn't do anything on Sunday.
This is why these are six-day matches.
Exactly. That's as long as they could be. And so they begin right after midnight, Sunday night, Monday morning, and then the competitors, the pedestrians, would go off. There were a team of judges that kept track of how many laps each competitor made, and they would continue walking as long as they could, as much as they could, right up until the following Saturday night at midnight. And whoever walked the farthest was the winner. I mean, the rules were pretty simple. But there were other things there, too. I mean, you had, you know, there would be brass bands playing music. Celebrities would stop by. You might see Tom Thumb at one of the big walking matches in New York City. So people went not just to watch people walk, but also for the spectacle of the event. And I like to say, you know, football games can be pretty boring, but there's a lot to see at a football game besides the football. And so that was one of the attractions of the sport.
And presumably watching people walk at the beginning of a six-day race was significantly different than what the spectacle was like 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 days
right
into this.
Right. The hottest ticket was for day six, because not only was that when the outcome would be decided, but also when the competitors were most bedraggled, dehydrated, sleep-deprived. They were just staggering around the track. I mean, I say it was like watching a NASCAR race in super slow motion, and part of the excitement of NASCAR is going to see the crashes, and this was the equivalent. This is when you would see the crashes would be on day 5 or 6. I mean, these guys would be so wiped out by then that it's really amazing that they were able to compete at all sometimes for 6 days.
This is almost the 19th century equivalent of an extreme sport.
Yeah, very extreme. They would be on the track, you know, upwards of 21 out of 24 hours a day. Usually they would sleep. They would usually have small cots, or they would even have small tents for them on the inside of the oval where they could sleep and also relieve themselves. But generally they'd be on the track about 21 hours a day, sleeping in, you know, 15 to 30 minute increments throughout the day. I go into the book in, I'm sure, excruciating detail about sleep patterns. But one of the things that these guys did is they slept by sleeping, you know, several times throughout the day. Most of us are monophasic sleepers. We just sleep once, and some are biphasic, where you sleep twice. Well, these guys, the best, I think, were polyphasic, where people can sleep several times throughout the day for 45 minutes or so. And this is what, you know, if you go, these guys who do a solo around-the-world boat races, they generally just sleep in small increments throughout the day.
Right, you're right. There's also like a subculture of pedestrianism where people would walk a mile every hour for as many consecutive hours as they could, and they would sleep basically from the moment they finished to the last
right
possible moment they could walk the next mile.
There was a guy in 1809, Captain Barclay was his name, a Scottish guy, and he walked 1 mile every hour for 1,000 consecutive hours to win a bet, which is, I think, 40-some days. And then, of course, somebody had to walk a half mile every half hour for 1,000 consecutive half hours. And then there was a woman, Ada Anderson, who took it to its ridiculous extreme by walking a quarter mile every 15 minutes for 1,015 minutes or whatever it was. So she got absolutely no sleep at all for 28 days. I mean, every 15 minutes she would walk a quarter mile. But that was one of the exhibitions that really attracted people's attention as well, these kinds of preposterous endurance events.
Well, and speaking of attention, this was a sport that was covered in the newspapers and magazines. What kind of reputation did pedestrianism have?
It had a mixed reputation, actually. The pedestrians were really the first celebrity athletes. They got endorsement deals. Some of them wore their sponsors on their shirt. So you're seeing the beginning of the corporate sports culture. They were really heroes, especially to a generation young men and women who would imitate them. You hear about kids going out and imitating the walk of their favorite pedestrian the way somebody might imitate their favorite baseball player's batting stance, right? But as pedestrianism got more popular with the public, it also became more popular with gamblers, and it had the influence and the association with gambling, also with alcohol. They would sell so much alcohol at these events. And, of course, the temperance movement was very much alive at that time, and so the temperance movement kind of advocated against pedestrianism. They thought it was basically unholy. And so you see kind of a backlash. There's an anti-pedestrianism movement in the country, if you can believe that.
And if I remember correctly from the book, a couple of Wisconsin newspapers were kind of trumpeting the cause of anti-pedestrianism.
Yeah, and I don't know why, but I saw some of the most virulent anti-pedestrian editorials were in Wisconsin papers. I have no idea why this is. Maybe somebody here has – do you have something against walking in Wisconsin? I don't know what it is exactly. But, yeah, there were two Wisconsin papers that editorialized against pedestrianism. But they were really – just an example. There were papers everywhere that thought it was – and they also thought it was kind of ghoulish in a way. That by watching these people put themselves through these exertions and really pushing themselves to the brink of mental and physical collapse, that there was exploitative,
right.
Yeah, about it, and that was another reason that people campaigned against it.
One of the other things that struck me, though, as we think back recently, we celebrated the anniversary of the integration of baseball, and that happened in 1947. Pedestrianism integrated 75 years before baseball.
Right. There were a number of famous black pedestrians. The most famous was a guy named Frank Hart. He was actually an immigrant from Haiti, moved to Boston, and on a lark entered a six-day race and won it, and so began entering more prestigious competitions and eventually won a couple very prestigious races. Pedestrianism really was a very democratic sport. I mean, if you were able to walk far in 6 days, you could compete on a level playing field, really. And so it opened doors for not only African Americans, but for Irish Americans and German Americans as well. It was a way to, much as sports are perceived this way today, it was a way to advance yourself, a way to make money, and a way to prove your worth.
Women did this too.
Yeah. Women pedestrians took part in six-day races. The women pedestrians had a major disadvantage, though, because the mores, would you say, of the time dictated that women covered, you couldn't show your calves. So the women all had to race wearing full-length, often very heavy velvet dresses and gowns. And so while the women competed and the races were very popular, they were at a decided disadvantage when it came to participating as opposed to the men who were able to wear tights and shorts.
So this booms fairly quickly, it seems, and the future seems very bright for pedestrianism. It ended almost as abruptly as it came up. What led to the end of pedestrianism, and why did the end come so quickly?
A couple of things. One, public confidence in the sport was really shaken by the association with gambling. There were gamblers that colluded with some of the lesser pedestrians to help fix races. There was also a doping scandal. One of the pedestrians was caught chewing coca leaves while he competed. And this also sort of hurt the perception, the public perception of pedestrianism. But the biggest thing that really killed pedestrianism in the end was the invention of the safety bicycle in 1885. an Englishman named Starley invented the bicycle. Before then, the bicycles were those kind that had the big front wheel and the tiny little back wheel, the penny farthing, and they were hard to race. They weren't very nimble. But the safety bicycle that Starley invented, which he named the Rover, incidentally, and then later made cars under that name, and the Land Rover and the Range Rover, kind of descendants of the safety bicycle. The safety bicycle was really nimble. It was quick, and you could race bicycles now easily. And, of course, watching a bicycle race, which also had the held the promise of crashes, was much more exciting than watching the pedestrians walk around in circles for 6 days. So really, the six-day bicycle races kind of replaced the six-day walking matches almost overnight.
How hard was it to find information about the sport? How much evidence is still out there? I mean, for example, you look at the book and it only has drawings of walking matches.
Yeah, we don't have any photographs that I've been able to find, unfortunately. Most of my research came, there were several different sources. The best was contemporaneous newspaper reports. We talked about how there wasn't much else to do. Well, one thing there was that you could do was read newspapers, and there were lots of newspapers back then. I mean, I forget, New York City might have had 30 daily newspapers at the time. And so it was a very popular sport, and it was covered in the popular press, and so there are lots of newspaper accounts of it. And also, I was able to go back and find some old programs. New York Historical Society has some of the old programs from the races, and that had a lot of biographical information about different competitors. And a couple of the major competitors, Edward West and Daniel O'Leary, they were actually the subjects of biographies. And so there was primary source material there as well.
You mentioned Madison Square Garden. That's obviously the Madison Square Garden that was first.
That was the Madison Square Garden that was actually at Madison Square.
There are not any... to our knowledge, there are not any arenas still standing today that host a pedestrian match.
Actually, there is the Royal Agricultural Hall in London is the one place where it was built, I think, in the 1860s, and it was abandoned in the 1960s, but it was saved from demolition, and it's now a convention center. So I was able to go to the Royal Agricultural Hall, the Aggie. It's now the Business Design Center. And that's the one place where the great walking matches were held that is still in existence.
Let's talk about America's other favorite pastime. What was baseball going through at the time pedestrianism was coming and going?
The National League was founded in 1876, right at about the time that pedestrianism is becoming popular. The National League, though, in the early years was very, very disorganized affair. Teams came and went. Some teams, if they were losing and out of the pennant race at the end of the season, would just quit and not play the rest of the games. I think at least one team got kicked out of the National League the first year. But by the 1880s, the owners got together and decided, well, we really need to organize this thing. They did a couple of things. They imposed a salary cap of $2,500, and they also introduced the reserve clause, which was a notorious clause that bound a player to his team in perpetuity, basically. There was no, they ended free agency. And so this really stabilized baseball. But by 1890, there are eight teams in the National League, and seven of them are still around. Only the Cleveland Spiders are no longer with us. The other seven teams in the National League still exist. The franchises have moved around, of course, a lot, but you can trace them right back to that that time. And so by 1890, baseball had really become a viable enterprise, and a lot of the people who had watched the walking matches and the bicycle races had moved on to baseball as their favorite pastime.
Well, Matthew Algio, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Matthew Algio is author of Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport, published by Chicago Review Press. He spoke with us this spring in front of a live audience at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. That's the Labor Day edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for spending part of your holiday weekend with us, and I hope you'll be back here again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you. Are you ready, Boots?